Good evening. And on behalf of Jews for Judaism and Torah in Motion, I want to welcome you to our annual This Time of the Year program. I'm not sure what to call it. And just want to let everyone know that tomorrow, again, we continue here at Shari Tfila at 9:30 in the morning with an all-day seminar going till around 3:30 in the afternoon. There are schedules outside. And I think that you'd find that program as well quite stimulating. I'm going to ask everyone that has one of these strange devices, I think these are from Star Trek, don't set it on stun or kill, but if you can set it on silent or vibrate, that would be appreciated, or just off totally. It's difficult to introduce someone who is going to be sharing really their life story, because as a public speaker, I'm always sensitive to the person doing my introduction to steal all my thunder. So I have to be a little bit discreet or circumspect in terms of what I'm going to share with you now. We just finished, just came out of the holiday of Hanukkah. We're really now sitting in the afterglow of Hanukkah. And we know every year that the story of Joseph in our Torah always coincides with the Hanukkah holiday. And our Hasidic sources tell us that there's a tremendous correlation between Joseph and the story of Hanukkah. When the Bible begins telling us about Joseph's story, the Torah says, Eile Toldos Yaakov, these are the descendants or the generations of Yaakov, and then you'd expect the Torah to tell us Jacob's children, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda. The Torah says, Eile Toldos Yaakov, these are the generations of Yaakov. And then it says, Yosef was 17 years old, he was taking care of his father's sheep. So the Hasidic commentaries explain, Eile Toldos Yaakov, not so much the children of Yaakov, the generations of Yaakov, but really Toldos in the sense of legacy. What is the legacy, the essence of Yaakov? We're all children of Yaakov here. We're all called Bnei Yisrael. So they explain the essence of Yaakov, the essence of what it means to be a Jew, is this idea of Yosef. Yosef means to increase, to go beyond, to do more. The entire holiday of Hanukkah really only came about because Jews were not satisfied with living on a simple, plain level. Their souls wanted to transcend. Their souls wanted more. They didn't need to find pure oil to light the menorah in the temple. The Jewish law stated that because the entire community was impure, when the whole community is impure, you don't need pure oil. They could have used any oil. But because the Hashmonaim didn't want to live life on a level of, okay, we can get by, it's good enough. They wanted to do it in the best way, in the ultimate way. So they sacrificed, and they went to the extra mile to get the very, very best purified oil. So because they had that initiative and that energy and that drive and that love and that passion, we were rewarded with this amazing holiday of Hanukkah. And that's the essence of Yosef, to go up, to increase. We know that we light candles one the first night, two the second night, three the third night, four the fourth night. That was also a subject of dispute in the Talmud. Beit Shammai says, no, you start with eight the first night, and seven the second night, and six the third night. But the Talmud says, no, we're mosif v'holech. We increase, we go up, we transcend. We're very blessed to be tonight sharing the evening with a very special individual who has that kind of a soul. Someone who you'll see was not satisfied with any static station in life. Someone who was seeking more. Someone who always, whose soul cried out to move up, to increase, to go beyond, to really seek more. I hope I'm not stealing this part of your thunder, Panina. But aside from Panina's spiritual elevation, after the seminar tomorrow on Monday, Panina is going to be making aliyah physically, going up to the land of Israel with her family to live. So it's really special sitting here in the afterglow of Hanukkah to spend time with an individual whose soul and whose body wants to go up, wants to increase, wants to become holier and higher and closer and closer. So it's my great privilege and pleasure to introduce Pnina Taylor tonight. She will tell you the story of her odyssey, and we'll have time afterwards for questions from the audience. Thank you so much.
I am actually on. Wow. Hi. Thank you, Rabbi Skobeck, for that wonderful introduction. And thank you all for being here this evening. I'm going to tell you a story this evening. In a way, it's many, many stories. I'm a person who loves jewelry. And so to me, to find a piece of jewelry that's been crafted by an artist, someone who is very, very talented, it's even more special than the actual beauty of the item, but to see the skill that went into it. And there's one jewelry maker, there's one artist who is the most fabulous craftsman of all. And he specializes in creating diamonds. The thing I love about diamonds is that no matter how you look at them, they always reflect slightly differently, depending on how it's cut and how you hold it in the light. I notice that when I go to a jewelry store, they always seem to sparkle a whole lot more than when I get them home. But depending on how you hold them, they show you a different side of themselves. My story is kind of like that because my life has been cut and designed by the master jeweler himself. And I'm going to show you one aspect of a story that has many, many facets to it. The story I'm going to tell you tonight is a Hanukkah story. And yes, I'm not afraid to say the word rabbi. It's also a Christmas story in a way. What a better way for all of us who don't celebrate that holiday to be spending time together. When I first started speaking, my family and I have been traveling for about 2 weeks in preparation to go to Israel, visiting family and making some stops along the way, several congregations that wanted to hear me before we left. And so I've spoken 3 times during the course of Hanukkah. This will be number 4. And so, of course, they asked me to try to tie in my story to the idea of Hanukkah. When I thought about it, you know, I first thought about the whole idea of light, right? We light the candles, we're bringing light into the world, we make all kinds of metaphors having to do with this light. And the opposite of light is what? Darkness, right? So I started to ponder the concept of darkness. What is darkness? And the first thought that I had was darkness is evil. Darkness is evil, right? Light is good, so darkness, the opposite of darkness, must be evil. But I realized that I was wrong. I was wrong because in order for evil to really be evil, there must be an element of light. In order for someone to choose what is wrong, they must know what is right. If they don't know what is right, they certainly can't choose to do what is wrong. So darkness is not evil. Darkness is ignorance. It's the inability to choose right or wrong, to make any choice whatsoever. And I was in a place of darkness. My story is coming from a place of darkness to a place of light. How wonderful, and to me, it's just an absolute beautiful parallel. The story of Hanukkah going from darkness to light, and my story going from complete ignorance to light. And that brings me to why this is also a Christmas story. Because I was raised in a family that was secular. Secular Jewish home. I was born into a Jewish family, but Judaism had no meaning to me whatsoever. In fact, my Jewishness explained why I had a big nose, why I talked with my hands, which you'll notice tonight I do a lot of, and why I like Chinese food. But that's about it. In fact, when I was about 8 years old or so, I remember talking to my mother, and I was so upset because all of my friends had Christmas trees in their home. And I asked my mom, you know, why don't we have a Christmas tree? And the answer was because we're Jewish. But that meant absolutely nothing to me. And I begged her and I begged her and I was like, I don't know, you know, you don't love us because we don't have a Christmas tree. So she decided to give in. And I remember this one night she was bringing upstairs this, 2.5-foot tree. And it was decorated with blue garland and blue and silver balls and blue and white lights. But she still didn't call it a Christmas tree. She called it a Hanukkah bush. Right? Now, I didn't know what the difference was. I was just happy that we had a tree in our house like all of my friends. But that was my Judaism. That was what I knew. In fact, in my family, the only real connection to Judaism, and my great-grandmother actually was religious to some extent, but I didn't understand the things that I saw going on in her life. When we had a Passover Seder in our home, what that meant was we went to my grandparents' house, and we sat down at the table, and my grandfather passed out the Maxwell House Haggadahs. And he said, okay, everybody turn to page 40. So we all turned to page 40, and he read one paragraph, and we sang the chorus for Dayenu, no verses, just the chorus, and then we sat down to a meal. And that was Passover for us. Now, the meal might have included matzah, but it also included bread and, I don't know, macaroni salad, probably fried chicken, who knows what else it included. But it definitely included gefilte fish, and it probably included matzah balls, or matzah. But that was Passover. Yet, to me, there was a positive Jewish connection there. So it was in this context of being a Jewish girl who had no idea what it meant to be Jewish. To me, Judaism was kind of like this ancient and archaic way of living. Whoops. Something to be remembered, maybe, but certainly not anything to be desired. Now, after many years, and I'm going to skip over quite a lot, but due to some abuse by a friend of the family, by the time I had reached high school, I was in a very, very bad place. I was depressed. I was suicidal. I really saw no hope. My life had spiraled into an abyss that I thought that there was no way out of. Now, I'm going to stop for a second and explain why I share this with you. Because I had someone criticize the fact that I'm sharing this in a public forum, and they warned me, and they were concerned about what people would think about me if they heard these things. But there's two reasons why these things need to be shared. Number one, in the Jewish community, we think that they don't happen, and they do. They happen all too much. Abuse is a very, very big problem. The other part of the reason that I share it, well, there's actually three reasons. The second reason that I share it is for you as my audience to be able to understand where I was at when I made certain decisions in my life. And the fact that being in a place of vulnerability, having been abused, needing to find a spiritual connection left me open to, as you'll see in a minute, to some things that otherwise I might not have been open to. And it helps you to understand where other people may be when they make these decisions. The third reason that I share these, especially when I am talking to young people, which there aren't so many of us here who are young people, so to speak, although I think most of us consider ourselves young people, but whatever, is that when I speak to teenagers and I tell them, look, I was abused, I was doing drugs, I was drinking alcohol, I was abusing my body, I was depressed. They know, A, that I've been honest with them, and B, that there's nothing that they can tell me that I'm going to judge them for. I've already heard it all. I've already seen it all. And so they can feel free to ask me the questions that they might be a little concerned about asking someone else, because they know that there's no judgment. And it works. I spoke this last weekend to a group of teenagers and had several of them approach me afterwards. So anyway, to tell you that I was in a really bad place is it's a big understatement. I was depressed and I saw no future and I saw no reason to live. And it was in this context, this place of vulnerability and desperateness, that a friend of mine from school approached me and offered me hope. It was like offering a glass of water to a person who was thirsty, who had been wandering in the desert for many years. It was only many years later that I realized that this glass of water she handed me had holes in it, and it didn't even contain any water. But at the time, it quenched a thirst that I had. And she showed me that what I needed was a spiritual connection to God. And I agreed with her completely. I believed that what she was telling me was absolutely the truth. So at 16 years old, my classmate introduced me to God and Jesus, and I became a born-again Christian. And my newfound faith gave me the strength to stop doing drugs, to stop drinking, to stop abusing my body. I started hanging around with a much better crowd of friends. I started doing better in school. In fact, my life so turned around that my mother and my sister also became Christians because of it. Now, I have people sometimes nowadays say to me, you know, you had a miracle happen in your life when you became a Christian. How can you no longer be a Christian? And I agree with them. I did have a miracle happen in my life, for sure. But it wasn't Jesus that did it. It's my willingness to open myself up and to have a relationship with God. And you can have a deep and meaningful relationship with God within the context of Judaism, and you don't need Jesus. So in my life, I had all of these changes occur. And like I said, my mother became a Christian as a result of it. My sister became a Christian as a result of it. Now, my parents had been divorced when I was young, when I was about 4 years old. And while I was going to church, I met a girl who became my best friend, and I began to fall in love with her brother. And he and I were dating, and we were getting serious. And I didn't think anything about it at the time that he wasn't a Jew, because we both believed the same thing. I wasn't thinking intermarriage, right? We both believed the same thing. And as we were getting more serious, I had this dream. I had this vision of my father walking me down the aisle when I got married. I don't know how many girls dream this. I mean, I hadn't seen my father in 15 years except one time. But I had this dream that my father was going to walk me down the aisle when I got married. And so I asked my mom permission to invite my father to come visit us. Now, mind you, I'd only seen him once in 15 years. But she said that that was fine, and we invited my dad to come visit us. So my dad came to visit us, and he fell back in love with my mother. They had been divorced for 15 years. And he asked her to marry him. But she was a Christian now, and he wasn't. And so she said, no, I can't marry you. You're not a Christian. So my sister and I went out, and we bought my father a Bible, and we shared with him about our beliefs. And my dad became a Christian as well. And my mother and my father got remarried. So I have a friend who later said, yeah, you brought them all on board and then jumped ship. Well, yeah, kind of. So my mom and my dad got remarried, and then my boyfriend and I got married, and we were married in a Southern Baptist church, just in case you were curious, and we got stationed in England because he was in the Air Force. While we were there, we had a couple of children, and something happened somewhere in there. One day, I heard a little voice. No, I don't have schizophrenia. I don't need to be committed, although some might think I do, but anyway. I heard a little voice telling me to start lighting candles on Friday night. Wasn't sure where it had come from. Didn't have this example in my life. Didn't have anybody in my home who lit candles on Friday night. But I felt like God was telling me to start lighting candles on Friday night. So I went to my husband and said, you know, I don't know where this is coming from, but I think God's telling me to light candles on Friday night. What do you think I should do? So he said, well, if that's what you think God is telling you to do, go ahead. So I dug out my grandmother's candlesticks and the Maxwell House Haggadah that I had in the bottom drawer of my cabinet, and I opened it to the first page because I remembered that in the front of the book was the blessing for lighting the candles on Friday night. Why? Because sometimes Passover starts on Friday night, right? So I opened the book. I used the transliteration, God bless Maxwell House, and I started lighting candles on Friday night and going to church on Sunday. This continued for a little while, lighting candles on Friday night, going to church on Sunday. And one day my husband comes downstairs and he says, Penina, I was reading in my Bible, and it says in there that there are some things that God told the Jewish people to do forever. And if the word forever means forever, and I'm to be right before God, then I need to make sure that my Jewish wife and my Jewish children do these things. Okay, he said, no more pork or shellfish in the house. Well, there went my ham and cheese sandwiches. But being a person who wanted to serve God wherever God wanted, however God wanted me to serve him, I reluctantly agreed to do this. So I'm abstaining from pork and shellfish. I'm lighting candles on Friday night, and I'm going to church on Sunday. Interesting picture. Another interesting thing happened. I was reading in the Christian Bible, and there's a passage in the New Testament, in the book of 1 Corinthians, that talks about head coverings. And so I read this passage, and I was kind of confused by it. And so we decided to invite our pastor to our home to ask him to explain it to us. He was a Greek scholar. This was in England. He'd probably studied at Oxford or something. And I asked him, "Pastor, what does this section mean?" And he said to me, "Well, it's very, very confusing. Even in the Greek, it's very difficult to understand." Said, "What do you think it means?" He says, "Well, I think what it means is that married women should cover their head when they're in prayer, at least in church, but probably anytime they're praying. But I can't teach that to women nowadays because they don't want to hear it." Well, you probably have already gotten a little bit of a clue just by hearing me that that was no reason for me not to do something. And so as I began exploring, I decided, well, if this is what God says that he expects from people, this is what I'm going to have to do. So I started covering my head. I wasn't eating pork and shellfish, and I was lighting candles on Friday night, and I was going to church on Sunday. And by the way, I was the only one in church on Sunday with their head covered, which was another story. But something began to happen inside. I couldn't put my finger on it then. Now I call it my spiritual identity crisis. But as I began to do these things that clearly God wanted me to do, I was opening up the ability for my Jewish soul to begin speaking to me and connecting to God. And so I began this struggle inside. I couldn't put my finger on it, didn't know what was happening, but I knew something wasn't right. Meanwhile, I was getting ready to have my second child, and so my parents came to visit us. And they hadn't seen us for a few years, and they brought with them an interesting thing. They had a suitcase full of Judaica. It had yarmulkes, it had shofars, it had tzitzit, it had tallits, it had all kinds of stuff, prayer books of all kinds. Now remember, my parents were Christians, right? And so I asked them about it, and they said they wanted me to get together a group of people for them, a group of my friends for them to speak to, because they were now part of something called Messianic Jewish Movement International. They were representatives of an organization that represented a group of Jewish people who had believed in Jesus and had found a way to synthesize their Jewish faith, their Jewish heritage with their Christian beliefs. They called themselves Messianic Jews. I found this very intriguing. It seemed to me like the solution to whatever this was that was going on inside of me. And so about a year later, when we came back to the United States, we sought out what we called a Messianic Jewish congregation. Now, I will stop for a second and tell you a little bit about the term Messianic Jew. When I'm not telling my story, you will often hear me refer to Jewish people who have become believers in Jesus as Hebrew Christians. In the Jewish community, that is what we prefer to call them, because they are Christians. And no matter how you slice it, when you lay down side by side what they believe with what any other Christian group believes, whether you're talking about the Southern Baptist Church or the Assemblies of God or any other denomination, you will see that what they believe is Christianity. It is not Judaism. However, as in a part of a desire to be accepted as a legitimate Jewish movement, they have chosen to call themselves Messianic Jews to distance themselves from the term Christianity. In fact, there's a book that was recently written by somebody with the organization Jews for Jesus entitled Messianic Judaism is Not Christianity, or so some say. Okay, and it's because there's this whole movement of Messianic Jews who have completely distanced themselves from Christianity and claim that what they have is the original Christianity. It is the true Judaism where God had wanted Judaism to go. All right, so I will flip back and forth between the terms Messianic Jew and Hebrew Christian, but to understand that we don't use the term Messianic Jew because we don't want to give validity to this idea that somewhere along the Jewish spectrum, from Orthodox to Conservative to Reconstructionist to Reform to Messianic. Messianic Judaism is not a part of Judaism, although in all honesty, we're all Messianic Jews. Because we're all awaiting the coming of the Messiah. We all are supposed to believe in the Messiah. It's our term, not theirs. So anyway, we came back to the United States, and we sought out a Messianic congregation, and we began attending this Messianic congregation. Now, something that I neglected to tell you was that when I became a Christian at the age of 16, it was a big deal. It was a big deal to the people around me anyway, because here I was, a 16-year-old girl who had become a Christian, had been delivered from drug abuse and from all of these bad behaviors, and the icing on the cake was that I was Jewish. And at that time, the phenomenon wasn't nearly as widespread as it is now, and they were very fascinated by this. When you add to it that I could also speak, you had a combination that was very enticing, and I began giving my testimony in churches all over the United States, well, all over the East Coast of the United States. I went to a Bible college. I was a counselor for the Billy Graham Crusade, and I married somebody who went to a Bible college. So together, we formed a team that was often brought into leadership in the churches that we were members of. So when we became members of the Messianic Jewish congregation, we were also brought into leadership there. And at some point later on, my dad decided that we needed to have a Messianic congregation closer to our home because we were traveling quite a distance to be there. And so he invited my husband and myself to help him and my mom start this Messianic congregation, and we did so. Now, at the time, I realized that I didn't know very much about being Jewish, and I figured that if we were going to be running a Messianic Jewish congregation, I should probably know something about Judaism. So in the process, I began to start reading books. The first book I read was a book by a woman named Blue Greenberg. It's called How to Run a Traditional Jewish Household. Gives a fabulous overview of traditional Judaism. And she's very careful to explain, you know, some do this and some do that, whatever. But one of the things that fascinated me was that she didn't really use the term Orthodox. The term that she used was Torah observant. And I thought that was a really great phrase. And I decided that what we needed to be was Torah observant Messianic Jews. And so we started the Torah Observant Messianic Jewish Movement. To this day, I believe that my father, because he was my father, I guess, our congregation is credited with the use of that term. It's a very widespread movement now. And in fact, that book that I mentioned to you that says that Messianic Judaism is not Christianity is basically Jews for Jesus railing on these Torah observant Messianic Jews and how they shouldn't be doing this at all. So it's become quite a big phenomenon and actually a little bit of a divisive thing in the Hebrew Christian Messianic movement. But anyway, so we started this Torah observant Messianic congregation. And in fact, my dad started the Association of Torah Observant Messianics. And in the process, I also read several other books that were very interesting. I don't know if you're familiar with the Kitzer Shulchan Aruch, but it's the condensed code of Jewish law. And I read this book three times in English. But it's one of those books that you really need to learn with a study partner, because if you don't, you can get some kind of strange ideas. There's a passage in there that talks about the holiday of Tisha B'Av. And it says in the passage that we don't wear shoes on Tisha B'Av. Now, I had no one to explain to me that it's leather shoes that we don't wear. So I had this vision of all of these Orthodox Jews in Baltimore walking around barefoot on Tisha B'Av. It was very interesting. And I had other ideas like that, too. But anyway, so we started this Hebrew Christian Messianic congregation. And after a little bit of time, my husband and I decided, you know, it's really kind of difficult co-leading with your parents. I'm sure some of you can identify with that. And we decided we loved them more than we cared about the congregation and decided that we needed to part ways. My parents continued running the congregation for several years afterwards, and we decided to go hide out in the Seventh-day Adventist church for a little while. It seemed to us to be a very very neutral environment. They worshiped on Saturday, so that took care of the Saturday-Sunday thing, and they were all vegetarians, so for the most part, that took care of the kosher issues. And we figured for sure this would be a place where nobody was going to ask us to lead anything and we'd be able to relax for a little while. Wrong. Didn't take very long before we were leading worship, which means the music group, and I was leading the women's prayer ministry and the children's Bible studies and all kinds of stuff like that. And it wasn't much longer before they came and asked us if we would start a Messianic congregation for the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Now, the interesting thing is that they were starting to see this phenomenon all over the United States where Christian churches were investing in messianic congregations, whether it's the Southern Baptists or the Assembly of God, or those are my two favorite, can you tell? But, you know, all of these different denominations that were starting messianic congregations, and they were seeing this influx of Jews who were becoming Christians. Now, they didn't realize that the majority of people in these congregations weren't Jewish to begin with. In fact, I think if you looked and examined all of the Hebrew Christian congregations across North America, you will discover that probably 70 to 75% of the members, and it might even be higher, are not Jewish, which presents a completely different problem. But the Seventh-day Adventist Church wanted a piece of this pie, because even though they're Christians, they're a different brand of Christianity, and they wanted to convert Jews to their brand of Christianity. My husband and I were flattered, but we chose not to join them because we felt that we couldn't buy into everything that they believed. And they did ask us one more time, and we said no. And at that time, my spiritual identity crisis began to rear its head again. Something about being in the Seventh-day Adventist Church just didn't quite work for me, and we sought out another messianic congregation. I know it sounds like we were all over the place. It really wasn't that much moving around. But we found a messianic congregation that was close to where we lived and close to where we worked. My husband worked. And while we were there, we were invited to an event at a messianic congregation in Baltimore, Maryland. And at this event, now remember, I'm a Torah observant messianic Jew. I'm covering my head. And at the time, I was dressing modestly, wearing only skirts. My sons were wearing yarmulkes and tzitzit. My husband was wearing a yarmulke and tzitzit, even though he wasn't Jewish. And if you had come across us on the street, you would have had no reason to think that we were anything other than your ordinary Orthodox Jewish family. Okay? So we're at this event at a messianic congregation in Baltimore, and a woman stops me and says, "How would you like to buy a really nice five-bedroom house in Upper Park Heights, Baltimore?" Now, for those of you who are not familiar with Baltimore, Upper Park Heights is the Orthodox community in Baltimore. And to boot, we were living in a very, 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 very small house. And I was homeschooling all four of my children in this very, very small house in my dining room. And the idea of a five-bedroom house just absolutely floored me to begin with. But then she said, to sweeten the pot, "I'll even help you with the financing." Now, I thought the woman was kind of nuts. I didn't realize that the way I looked had something to do with the reason that she approached me. She knew I was messianic. She didn't think that I was something else. But I decided I knew how to get out of this problem. I was going to blame it on my husband. You know how this works, ladies, right? So I told her, "Let me ask my husband," because I knew what his answer was going to be. He was going to look at me and he was going to say, "What? Are you nuts? We're not moving to Baltimore. We lived an hour south of Baltimore. He worked an hour south of where we lived. We worshipped an hour south of there. Baltimore was nowhere on our radar screen whatsoever." So I said, "Hang on, let me ask my husband." And I went to my husband and I said, "You know, there's this woman and she's offering us this house. And I know it's kind of crazy, but I told her I'd ask you. What do you think?" And he says to me, "Well, we can go look at it." I think that was the first and probably the last time I was ever speechless. I didn't know what to make of it. But I went to her and I said, "Well, my husband says we can look at the house." So we made an appointment and we went and looked at the house. And of course, you know, I fell in love with the house because I had to. It was three times the size of the house I was living in, right? It almost doesn't matter what it looked like. But something else interesting happened. When we drove up, that little voice that told me all those years ago to start lighting candles on Friday night, it started talking to me again. And it said, "You're home." I didn't know exactly what that meant, but I listened to it. And we went into the house, and we thought it was a fabulous house. Not only was it big, but it was one of those houses that started out small and had been expanded this way and expanded that way, so it had a lot of character. And we fell in love with the house. So then we did what all good Christians do. And we went back to our congregation and asked them what we should do. So they all prayed for us, and they decided unanimously that we should buy this house in Baltimore. Why? Who better to witness to Orthodox Jews than Messianic Jews who look like Orthodox Jews, right? So they sent us off with a big farewell and wished us the best, and we moved to Baltimore. Now, we didn't know at the time that the woman who we bought the house from, who had been an active missionary, I mean, I knew she was a Christian, and she wasn't Jewish, even though she went to a Messianic congregation, But I didn't know that she had been actively missionizing in the community, and I didn't know that she took it upon herself to tell the community that a nice Messianic Jewish family was moving in. And so we moved in, and we couldn't understand why none of our neighbors came to greet us when we moved in. And in fact, not only had they not come to greet us, but the neighbors on the right side purposely kept their backs to us so that when we were outside going, "Hi, how you doing?" they wouldn't have to respond. They didn't know what to do with us. They weren't really trying to be rude. They didn't know what to make of us. So we moved in and we had this kind of cold reception in our community, on our block, but nobody else in the community knew about us because, I mean, it was a big community. Well, we started discussing things and decided that since we were being Torah observant, there was now no reason to break Shabbat and drive, that we would keep our fellowship with the Messianics on Wednesday, but that we would go to an Orthodox synagogue on Saturday. There was no reason to drive, and it would certainly hurt our witness to our neighbors. So we found a congregation. It was a Lubavitch, Chabad congregation, because not only do Messianics have an affinity with Chabad, which I'd be more than happy to explain later, but we had, over the years, I had actually made the acquaintance of the rabbi because he owns the bookstore that I frequented, and we had been over the years receiving Chabad calendars. Everybody knows the holiday literature and all of that. And so we felt a little bit of a familiarity with that, and so we sought out the Chabad shul. It also turns out that the Chabad shul was the second most popular shul in the community for homeschoolers. So as soon as we started going to this congregation, people started to you homeschool, let me introduce you to this family, let me introduce you to that family. And it was only a couple of weeks before we had several friends in the community, in the congregation, and we were starting to feel knit in to the community. We were starting to feel accepted and to feel a part of it. And in fact, they had even helped me with my ignorance. Like, I sat there and they were doing the Torah reading and someone showed me where in the Tanakh, where in the Torah they were reading from. And they were very, very helpful and they were very warm and they were very receptive. And even though my husband wasn't Jewish, they accepted him as well. So one day my husband, who is a man of tremendous integrity, says to me, we really need to tell the rabbi that we believe in Jesus. Even if we don't tell anybody else, someday it's going to come out and he needs to know so that he doesn't believe that we were being deceptive and, whatever, he should know. So we invited the rabbi to come to talk to us. And we didn't tell him ahead of time what we were going to talk to him about. And he figured, since he knew my husband wasn't Jewish and I was, that we were going to talk to him about what? Conversion, right? Either that or maybe getting our kids into Hebrew school or something like that. But that's what he figured. So he came in and he sat down and my husband started to tell him what he believed. And he's going on and on. And the rabbi stops him and he says, "But okay, so you don't believe that anymore, right?" My husband says, "No. I do." Well, in the few seconds that it took for shock to register on the face of the rabbi, I saw my entire world imploding. I mean, in the short time that we had been there, we had already started to make friends, not only in the shul, but in the surrounding neighborhood among the homeschoolers. My kids were starting to get it knit in and all of this other stuff. And I could see the rabbi's going to kick us out of the shul. None of the kids in the community are going to be allowed to play with my kids. What kind of a life are we going to have here in this new, big, beautiful house? I mean, what is the value of the house if we don't have a neighborhood to go with it? And so I began to cry. And I begged the rabbi not to kick us out of the shul. And I begged him not to, not allow people to have anything to do with us. And the rabbi said to me one of the most important things that anybody has ever said to me on my journey. He said to me, "You are a Jew no matter what you believe, even if what you believe is not Jewish." That's an important distinction. A Jew never stops being a Jew. A Jew never stops being responsible before God for what he was designed to do in this world. Now, if you believe in Jesus, you are no longer practicing Judaism. Don't mistake me one bit. It's not Jewish, not in the least. But you are still a Jew. We don't have to convert to come back. We just have to make tshuva like everybody who does something they shouldn't do. Okay? And he said to me that the children and I could continue to come to the synagogue. He wasn't sure what to do with my husband, and so he asked that he not come for a little while. But he allowed me and my children to continue to come to synagogue. He said, but there's one caveat. You have to talk to a man from an organization called Jews for Judaism. I'm not sure how many of you here are familiar with Jews for Judaism. They're the co-sponsors of this program, so I'll assume you have at least heard of them. But Jews for Judaism is primarily the Jewish community's answer to aggressive and deceptive missionary tactics by organizations that target Jews for conversion to some form of Christianity. They also deal with other religions as well. I didn't know that much about Jews for Judaism, but I had some idea in my mind that they probably didn't like Christians. And I was very reluctant to agree. But it's kind of like, you know when you buy a piece of software and you stick it on your computer and you get this window that says, I agree to these terms, and you're supposed to read this whole big long list of terms and click, I agree. And there's also a box for you to click, I don't agree, right? But nobody clicks it because what happens? You can't load it onto your computer then, right? So you click the I agree button regardless of what it says in the terms of service. I mean, I got to the point where I stopped reading it because it really didn't matter. If I wanted the software on my computer, I was going to click I agree, right? Like even if it says that you promised to give your big toe after 2 years, I wouldn't even know it was in there. So I said, okay, fine. We'll talk to this guy. And, you know, I dodged him for a little while. And finally, the rabbi said, you know, you really need to call this guy. So we called him. And he came over to our house. And he comes in and he says, so let's talk about why you think Jesus is the Messiah. Okay? Okay, my husband starts talking. I wasn't going to say anything. He starts talking and he brings up a point. And the guy says, well, let's look at it. And he pulls out the Hebrew scriptures and he shows us that this doctrine, this Christian belief that we had, was based on a Jewish scripture that had been mistranslated and taken out of context. In fact, there was a peripheral issue that we brought up that was also shown to not be true. That was all we discussed that evening. It was probably less than an hour discussion. I'm probably talking to you longer than he spoke to us. But he left me with a tremendous amount to think about. If this one core belief that I held was based on a scripture that was mistranslated and taken out of context, how many other beliefs did I hold that were based on falsehoods? So after a few days of chewing on this, I decided to call him and ask him a few more questions and a few more questions and a few more questions. Because as you can tell, I like to talk. But I wanted answers to my questions. And so I came every few days to his office and I said, well, what about this? And what about this? And each and every time he was able to show me that these beliefs were based on untruths. I have to tell you that probably 90% of what I believed was based on a lie, a Hebrew scripture that was either mistranslated, taken out of context, both, or in some cases completely fabricated. It didn't take very long for the bricks from the foundation of my faith to come out and for that foundation to completely crumble. What choice did I have? What I believed was based on a lie. And so at that point, I had to reevaluate what it was I believed, one by one, piece by piece, to rebuild that foundation. Now, obviously, I'm standing here talking to you because where it led me to was Judaism. Now, at the time, my children were 12, 10, 8, and 6. My 12-year-old was a boy who was a year away from becoming bar mitzvah. So while I was going through this period of discovery, as I would come across something, I would present it to my son. I would say, you know, it says in the book of Daniel, this. Christians believe this. This is what Judaism teaches. What do you think? And in the process, my son also came along. And I mean, one of the things that I love about this man from Jews for Judaism was he said to me, if it's not there, I can't make it appear. And if it is there, I can't make it disappear. The point being is that the majority of these proofs, the majority of these scriptures, first of all, it only takes like a kindergarten or first grade level of Hebrew to be able to understand what it's saying. It really doesn't take a scholar. It's not like, you know, you have to rely on what somebody else is saying and maybe they're wrong. It's very, very basic. And so I presented these things to my children. to my son specifically. And by the time I had come around, I mean, a couple of months later, he also came around, and he decided that he believed the Jewish understanding of these things. And when he was bar mitzvahed a year later, at that point, like maybe 8 months later, he was bar mitzvahed in a Chabad, in the Chabad shul. And he had embraced Judaism wholeheartedly. My other children came along, you know, the 6-year-old and the 8-year-old, it was more like, oh, we don't talk to Yeshua anymore, okay. Because remember, we had been Messianic. We had been Torah observant Messianic. So my children had some kind of a Jewish identity. In fact, my youngest two never recall calling us anything other than Abba and Ima. And my youngest two children have never eaten any treif food, okay? So the transition was not nearly as difficult as you might think it was. It was hardest on my son, but because he felt like he was owning this, he was discovering it as well, for him it was a pretty smooth transition. About a year after, around the time of my son's bar mitzvah, my parents, who I had kind of been plugging away, hey dad, did you look at this? Hey dad, did you look at that? He was at the bar mitzvah and he met the guy who sat in my living room. And they had a very, very long talk. And my dad decided that he didn't believe those things anymore either. And so my dad and my mom came back to Judaism as well. In fact, they moved to Baltimore near us. And a year and a half ago, they made Aliyah to the community that we're now making Aliyah to. We're kind of following them for the first time. But about a year after that, my husband decided that he could no longer consider himself a Christian. He wasn't interested in converting to Judaism because he wasn't sure that he wanted to trade one flawed religion for another. But he knew from the things that I had showed him that he could no longer believe what he had believed. And he struggled for the next 2.5 years to figure out who he was in his relationship with God. He knew he still believed in God. He knew he couldn't be a Christian anymore. To him, the Noahide movement wasn't quite enough. And he knew that God had given him a Jewish wife and Jewish children for a reason. And he needed to figure this out. And about 2 years ago now, he decided that God had given him this Jewish family because he was calling him to be Jewish himself. So 2 years ago, my husband converted to Judaism, and we were married by a rabbi in our community. And so since then, our family has been completely whole, completely Jewish, and now we are all making Aliyah together. And I am still married to the same man that I was married to, that I've been married to for 19 years. So that kind of brings us up to modern history. About a year and a half ago, I came to Jews for Judaism, and I said, you know, I spent a lot of time teaching in the churches and telling my story and helping all of these Jewish, I don't know that I actually helped a lot of Jewish people come to believe in Jesus, but I probably helped some. And I would like to make a tikkun. I would like to fix the things that I've done, and I would like to work for the organization. Generally speaking, the organization doesn't hire people just because they have a story. I mean, you can speak, but I felt that I also had a particular skill set that would work. And I joined up with Jews for Judaism, and I began working for Jews for Judaism. And I didn't leave until we were getting ready to make Aliyah, which we are doing on Tuesday. My whole family and I are making Aliyah on Tuesday. We are going with Nefesh B'Nefesh, and we are going to be living about a 20-minute drive from Jerusalem. And I'm going to be starting an organization in Israel that will hopefully meet the missionary threat there. To give you an idea, I know that this number applies to the United States. I'm not sure if it's all of North America. They say that there's about 500 Hebrew Christian congregations in North America in Israel. About 100 of them, or one-fifth, are in Israel. Now, if you think about the number of people, the size of this country, and you think about the size of that country, for one-fifth of all of the Hebrew Christian congregations to be in Israel, that's an awfully large number. And the people who are most at risk are the Russian immigrants and the secular Israelis. And so I hope to go over there and to continue the work that I have been so blessed to be a part of with Jews for Judaism and continue to address these issues. So I want to thank you for having me here tonight and giving me the opportunity to speak to you. I want to thank Rabbi Skobach and Julia Siss, who's not here this evening but will be here tomorrow, for inviting me and having me. And I'm going to open up to questions, if that's appropriate. We have a microphone here, so if you have a question and you want to come to the microphone, that way I won't have... I won't have to repeat the question. That would be really good. So do you want people to raise their hand or just to come up one by one? Come on to the mic. Or maybe we could have somebody bring the mic around. I don't know if that would... when my children were born, were they circumcised? Well, that's a good question. Yes, they were. When my firstborn son was born, I didn't know very much. And I don't even know that I knew about a moil, but I knew that my son had... I knew that my son had to be circumcised. So he was circumcised by a doctor and in the hospital. And in fact, I had to kind of have a fight with them because the trend kind of goes up and down as to whether or not it's acceptable in society to perform circumcision or not. And at the time, the trend was down. And so I had to convince him, which was very difficult for me to do. So then later on, before his bar mitzvah, he had to have a ceremony to make it kosher. My other two children were circumcised by a moil. So my other two boys, I have three boys and one daughter. Okay, we have another question. Yes? Are you, okay. Come to the mic, please. Yeah.
Have you found that the Messianic movement is trying to infiltrate Israel, and they would even go so far as to have some of their members convert here, let's say Reform or Conservative, in order to have entry into Israel because the state of Israel has allowed non-Orthodox conversion since the year 1992 approximately?
Absolutely. That's a very good question. In fact, part of what I've done on a very informal basis is I've had a lot of work with the Jewish agencies in the United States, a couple of the offices, in helping to stop over a dozen Messianic Jews from making Aliyah in the past year. It used to be that when Messianic Jews would try to make Aliyah, if they were asked, you know, do you believe in Jesus? Well, they could justify saying no because they felt that their belief in Yeshua, which is what they believe was his Hebrew name, is different than asking if they believe in Jesus because that means that they've become Gentile Christians and they're not. And so they were playing this little semantical game. However, in recent years, we have found a new phenomenon. And by the way, pushed up against the wall, they would not lie. Because in the New Testament, there's a verse that Jesus says, if you deny me before men, I will deny you before my Father in heaven. So the idea is, if you deny that you believe in Jesus, well, you're not going to have a place in heaven anyway. So if pushed up against the wall, if you use the right terms, they would have to admit that they were Messianic Jews. However, in recent years, we have found that they are more than happy to outright lie. In fact, I had an incident where I was talking to somebody from the Jewish agency, and she said, okay, when you get done looking at this person, I have a couple of other names of people that I'm a little concerned about. Can you look them up? I mean, one guy's name is John Smith, and one guy's name is Renee Block, and one guy's name is whatever. And I said, wait a minute, Renee Block? That is just the most famous saxophone player of the most, the most popular Messianic band, a group called Israel's Hope. And he's a pastor of two congregations in California. I said, hang on a second. So I pulled it up on my computer and I said, go to this website. So she went to the website and she saw, and I said, is that a picture of the guy? And she said, yeah. And I asked him, do you believe in Yeshua? I asked him, do you believe in Jesus? I asked him, are you a Messianic? You know, I asked him all of the questions, and he said no. So what's happening is that they are doing whatever they can to make Aliyah. Now, I happen to have transcribed a copy of a tape from a Messianic Jewish conference that happened 2 years ago, where they had what they called an Aliyah forum. They had all of these Messianic Jews who had made Aliyah over the past few years come in and talk to Messianic Jews about how to make Aliyah. And they told them what kind of relatives they could claim to be able to get their citizenship, and if they were approached this way, how they could respond, and all of this stuff. And it was really sickening. It was very, very difficult to digest. But the worst part about it for me was that they talked about how they need to get as many Messianic Jews into Israel as possible so that they can begin to infiltrate the political system so that they can change the laws. They want to make it totally acceptable for Messianic Jews to be considered in Israel as another stream of Judaism. Now, as far as the specific question that you asked about converting to Judaism through Reform and through Conservative, I don't know that it's happening in large numbers yet, but I do know that it has happened. Our first indication that there was a problem with this was when I got a call from somebody in the Jewish agency who said, look, you know, I have this guy, he converted by a conservative rabbi, and the rabbi is legitimate, but something just doesn't match, because when they sent in this picture, they look like Chabadniks. They're, you know, he's wearing black and white, he's wearing a hat, she's got a scarf on her head, and they've got this whole passel of kids, and it just doesn't look like your typical conservative family. And so, lo and behold, we discovered that there was a problem. The conversion technically was legitimate. I mean, the rabbi was legitimate, and for whatever reason, I guess the rabbi didn't ask the right questions because they slipped through the cracks. But they were on their way to Israel, except that I think that they were stopped. I don't know for sure. But you can see how this is definitely in trend. And even when we were in Messianic Judaism, we were encouraged for my husband to convert Reform. Because they wouldn't ask him to deny his Christian beliefs. They probably wouldn't even ask him about his Christian beliefs, and at least then he could claim he was Jewish. Because in the Messianic movement, there were still some who said, you know, like, if you were Jewish, you could have this role in the congregation, but if you weren't, you really couldn't. And there was a little bit of whatever. So they had encouraged him, you know, go ahead and convert Reform, then you can say you're Jewish already, because somebody accepts you as Jewish. So it's definitely a phenomenon, and it's definitely a problem. Anyone else? Yes. Would you mind coming to the microphone? How do you get rid of the darkness on the 24th of December? I'm not exactly sure what you're talking, where you're headed with that question. I have had some questions from people about what we do about non-Jewish holidays that are so enticing and so warm and inviting. The specific question that I had most recently was about Halloween. Am I correct that this is the direction you're asking? One of the things that I've done with my children is that I have tried to show them, of course, that we have this myriad of holidays that we celebrate that are ours. I talked to them about, for example, you know, some holidays are ours and some holidays aren't. There's a holiday called Ramadan that happens every year, but that's a Muslim holiday, and we're not Muslim, and so we don't celebrate that holiday. One of the examples in my article may have even been about Canada Day or whatever, you know, like, I mean, we celebrate the holidays that apply to us. And in Judaism, we have so many holidays that are so amazing. Why do we need to add one more? I mean, if you want a holiday where, like, you know how on Easter they, like, go looking after eggs, right? They go and find something. Well, on Passover, we look for the Afikoman. If you want to find a holiday where you string garland and lights and have greenery and stuff, well, we do that kind of stuff on Sukkot. If you want a holiday where you get to stay up all night like New Year's, well, we do that on the first night of Shavuot. If you want a holiday where you get to get drunk, we have two or three of those. I mean, you name it, we've got it. And so why do we need any more, right? So to try to encourage people to focus on what we do have instead of on what we don't have. And I think that there's a lot of that in the story of Hanukkah about preserving what we've got and not being jealous of what isn't ours and trying to become something that we're not. Yes? What happened to my sister? I don't know. Can we cut this part out of the tape? My sister is still involved in Messianic Judaism. She is very heavily involved in her congregation. She lived with us for a short period of time, and I had hoped that I had had some influence, and I did in a way. She told me that her understanding of Judaism was a lot different, and that where she had thought that Jews were hopelessly lost and had no concept of a relationship with God, she now agreed that there was a dimension to our relationship with God that she didn't know existed before. I don't think she's admitted yet that I'm probably not going to hell. I think she's still thinks I'm headed there, but that's where she is, and you know, I do what I can do, and we do have a good relationship, though. We have learned how, and this is important, if you have a relative who's involved in Christianity, this is really, really, really important. Don't close the doors on them. Keep the lines of communication open. Find what you have in common, and put the things that you don't have in common off the table. Because the one thing that we do want is we want them to come back to Judaism. And if we shut them off and if we close them off, they're never going to come back because all they're going to see is rejection and bitterness. And that's not what we want. My sister now has an opinion of Judaism, of traditional Judaism, that she had no clue before. And I don't know what that means. Down the road, maybe she may come back. But to keep those doors open because it's very, very important. We're going to a community called Kochav Yaakov. It's 6 miles north of Jerusalem. It is over the Green Line. And it's a beautiful, beautiful community. It's a religious yeshuv, but it has the entire gamut of religious Jews, from everything to what we would consider here in the United States traditional modern, all of the way to Hasidic Haredi and everything in between. And it's about 10% Anglo, meaning people who speak English. It's about 70% French Olim. And then the other 20%, I don't know if I did my math right, but the rest of them are native Israelis and Taimani, which are Yemenite. Okay, anybody else? Yes.
I'd like to go back in time and go back to your grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
When the lady asked about my grandparents, I have grandparents on both my mother's and my father's side. The grandfather that I was talking about with the Maxwell House Haggadah was on my mother's side. My father's family had been Orthodox when he was a very young child and had been conservative when I was growing up, but we didn't have a lot of contact with them simply because we didn't see my father, and so there was a lot of tension there. So mostly it was my mother's parents that we had contact with. Where did I live? I was born in Lakewood, New Jersey, and no, I wasn't. I'm not from Canada. I'm from the United States, and I spent 10 years there. Did I hear a gasp? Please. I have to tell you, it's really funny because I was born in a secular home, right? And here I am, I'm in this Orthodox community. And so he says, oh, where are you from? I said, what do you mean? You mean where I was born? And they say, yeah. And I say, oh, I was born in Lakewood. And they go, New Jersey? And I go, yeah, why? And they're like, oh, Lakewood, New Jersey. You know, so I got to the point where I was like, yeah, that means the Shekhinah rests on my shoulders, right? There are secular Jews in New Jersey, in Lakewood, as a matter of fact. But so I spent the first 10 years of my life in the Lakewood, Jackson, New Jersey area. And then my family moved to Miami, Florida. And I spent the next 10 years growing up in Miami, Florida. My great-grandmother had been religious before she came over from Poland. But as you know, in the early 1900s, if you were a religious Jew, it meant that, you know, every Saturday, every Sunday or Monday morning, you had to start looking for a new job because you couldn't keep Shabbat. And if you wore a yarmulke, you would probably get beaten up and things like that. And so my great-grandmother's children, my grandmother and her two brothers, ended up becoming completely secular. And it was in that context. My mother was raised in a completely secular home. In fact, it's really interesting because my great-grandmother passed away before I came back to Judaism. And I have a lot of fond memories of her, but a lot of them were kind of confusing. Like, I remembered that every once in a while when we'd come to visit Bubby, she would say, good yontif, but I didn't know what that meant. And I remembered her always washing the dishes with her hands. Like, no sponge, no towel, you know, no washcloth, nothing. She always washed them with her hands. And what I realized now, looking back, that maybe it was on Shabbat that she was washing the dishes, and so she couldn't use something that she would squeeze out. It's only now that some of the things that I observed that I thought were totally crazy, not only do I now understand them, but I find myself doing them, which is kind of funny, because I have become my great-grandmother. Anyway, yes. Okay, do I and my family speak Hebrew, Kitzat, which means a little, and actually lo kol kach tov would be the better way to say it, which means not very well. And will my husband work in Israel? God willing, he will work in Israel. Right now, actually, I'm hoping that he will have the opportunity to learn for a little while at a school like Esh HaTorah, which caters to a lot of people who have come back to Judaism. But that's all going to depend on how much I can earn doing my work as to whether or not he'll be free to do that, which I would like to be able to do that for him. But we'll have to just see. They say that it takes 6 to 9 months, because, of course, the first 5 months we're in Ulpan learning Hebrew in Israel. So they say it usually takes 6 to 9 months to be able to get a job. Some people get a job before then. My husband's in computers, so hopefully that means that he'll be able to get a job sooner. But, all right. Yes?
Sort of embrace Christianity because she didn't convert. She embraced, you know.
Right.
But that's a different question. You know, what made you, and how did you become spiritualized?
Okay, so the question has to do with, I was raised in a non-spiritual home, and when I embraced Christianity, how did I become, I guess, how did I suddenly desire a spiritual connection, you're saying?
What
was it that grabbed me? What grabbed me was that the woman who spoke to me, the young girl who spoke to me, explained to me that my life was no different than anybody else's. We all sin, right? She said, we all have bad things happen in our life. And that Jesus came, for lack of better terms, to make it all better. That all I had to do was believe in Jesus and I could have a relationship with God. Now, I recognized that I needed a relationship with God. I mean, that made sense to me when she started to explain. And so the fact that this was really an easy way to get it done was very appealing to me. You mean all I have to do is believe in him and that's it? And so that was it. But also, in addition to this idea that it was very easy and all I have to do is believe in Jesus to have a relationship with God, was the other aspect that people need to be aware of, and that was a support group. As soon as I believed in Jesus, I suddenly had 20 or 30 friends that I did not have before. I suddenly had people who loved me no matter what I looked like, no matter what I did, no matter, you know, it didn't matter to them. And they embraced me and they loved me in a way that nobody had ever done. And the church is very, very good at this. And I think that it's a lesson that we as Jews can learn, is to be more loving to each other and to provide that network. If you see somebody in synagogue, it doesn't matter what denomination you go to, that you haven't seen before, go up to them, shake their hand, say hello, how are you doing? Do you need something? I decided one day to put this into practice. And I was at synagogue. And I saw a woman that I had never seen before. And so I went up to her and I said, hi, how are you doing? My name is Penina. Welcome to our shul. And she said, hi, I'm the president's wife. I was a little embarrassed. But she was happy that I had taken the risk of embarrassing myself to try to reach out to another person in the congregation. And I think that we all need to do that just a little bit more. Because that's how we can keep people, you know, in. Yes. What were your motivations for Aliyah? What were my motivations for Aliyah? Well, my husband had been working in Northern Virginia, and probably a lot of you don't know the geography of the Washington, D.C., Baltimore area. But Washington, D.C. is situated where it's right in between Maryland to the north and Virginia to the south and to the west. And my husband was working in Northern Virginia, which is kind of a suburb of Washington, D.C., and we were now living in Baltimore. Shortly before we moved to Baltimore, he started to look for a job closer to home. It started out that he had about an hour commute, and after about 7 years of this, 6.5 years of this, the commute had grown to 2, and if there was inclement weather, 3 hours each direction. Now, during those 6 years, no doors had opened. I mean, it's not like there are no jobs in Baltimore for database people. There are lots of jobs, but for whatever reason, he couldn't get one. And we began to wonder if whatever it was that God had brought us to Baltimore for, which is pretty obvious, was finished, and now it was time for us to move somewhere else. So we began thinking about selling our house and maybe moving to another Jewish community, maybe one that was less expensive so that we would have fewer obligations. So we looked into Minneapolis, Minnesota. We looked into, actually, New Hampshire, which doesn't have any Jews, but that's another story. No, it's not that it doesn't have any Jews, but it didn't have a Jewish community that we were looking at. We looked in a lot of different places. We looked in Florida. We looked at, and my husband sent out his resume, and nothing came up. And we had talked, now it's about 10 years ago, when we were still messianic, about making Aliyah, for many of the reasons that I discussed that the messianics are discussing making Aliyah. And for one reason or another, it had kind of fallen through. But I've always felt like the reason that God had not allowed me to visit Israel was because he knew I would not come back. My heart was there from the very beginning, from as soon as I started learning about the country. And so when we realized that none of these other doors were opening up, we looked at the option of since we were thinking about selling our house anyway, of making Aliyah. My parents had made Aliyah a year and a half before, and of course they were like, come on, come on, you've got to do this too. And then my dad sent out an email about 2 weeks, 3 weeks before Passover. He sent out this email to all these people that follow what he's doing, and it said that last year when they were at our home and they were saying next year in Jerusalem, you know, they were thinking about how they were making Aliyah and how wonderful it was, and that it was their hope that this year when his family is sitting there without them saying next year in Jerusalem, that it would equally tug at our heart. And, you know, I mean, come on, he's good at the Jewish guilt, right? But guess what? It worked. And as I sat there, the first Passover in many, many years that my parents were not at our home, and we sang next year in Jerusalem, and I said, maybe it's time. Let's take a look. And so we evaluated our situation, and except for one member of our family, the timing made tremendous sense. So we decided to take a pilot trip to Israel and to explore our options, and we decided to make a go of it. And now we are. Yes. It's okay.
People from your past congregations try and come over to you and reconvert you, as it were?
You know, it's interesting. In the very, very beginning, there was some of that that went on. Because remember, my husband was still believing in Jesus. But after a while, no. In fact, it's interesting. I had a very good friend. You know, it only happens in your life once or twice that you have what you would call a best friend, right? Somebody that you find that you really, really connect to, especially as an adult. We just don't make those kinds of relationships as adults. And when you find a friendship like that, it's very, very special. And I had a best friend. And when I came back to Judaism, she said to me, we're still going to be friends. And I didn't hear from her for a couple of weeks. And then she called me and she said, you know, I wouldn't be your friend if I didn't tell you that I feel that you are hopelessly lost and going to hell. I said, thank you very much. I hung up. And it was about 3 months later that she called me back and said hello. And it was about 6 months after that that I got another call, and a year and a half after that. So her first attempt was definitely to try to bring me back. But after that, it was just to let me go. Because apparently she couldn't find anything that we had in common, except for our belief in Jesus. And since that was gone, that was the end of the relationship. I lost a lot when I came back to Judaism. I lost a huge, huge support network. I lost a huge, huge reputation that I had in the congregation that we were a part of. And to be honest with you, I think it was all worth it. And I would do it again. Absolutely. Okay. Gentleman back there. Do I think it would be a good idea for Jews to proselytize non-Jews? Ooh, that's a loaded question. No, I don't. I'll tell you why. Number one, we're told not to. Number two, if you proselytize to a non-Jew, what are you doing? You're convincing them to become Jewish. And the Jewish faith teaches, and this is one of the biggest things that separates us from Christianity, right? Christianity says, believe this way or you're going to hell. You can't have a relationship with God, period, end of subject. And Judaism teaches that the righteous of all nations have a place in the world to come, that anybody who seeks God can have a relationship with God. So they don't all need to become Jews. And it's like the analogy of the body, right? If my entire body were hands, what would I look like? How would I function? We all have different callings and different purposes in this world. And some of us are called to be Jews, and some of us are called to be non-Jews. And it doesn't make any of us better. It makes us different. And we have different jobs to do. And if we didn't have those, then the world wouldn't function like our bodies function. So, no, I don't believe it is a good idea to do that. Yes. I think that's me. That's not the Brotman family, is it? No? It's a different family? Okay, go ahead.
And they turned them away. And he has to be buried in a non-Jewish cemetery.
Right.
Okay, and another thing. I want to know, how did you get in touch with Nefesh the Nefesh? Because my daughter-in-law sister, you know, they went to Israel on that program. And how did they contact you?
All right, so the first statement was about a pastor who was of Jewish background who passed away, and his family wanted him buried in a Jewish cemetery, and he was stopped from being buried in a Jewish cemetery. You know, Judaism teaches that even though you don't ever stop being a Jew, that if you don't live as a Jew, if you embrace another religion, if you do certain things, you can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery, and that's just the way it is, and that is the rule for somebody who embraces Christianity. The question about how did I get in contact with Nefesh B'Nefesh, I found out about the organization kind of, I guess, through the grapevine, and you can look them up on the internet. All you have to do is put in Nefesh B Nefesh, and you'll find actually it's like www.nefeshbenefesh.com, no punctuation in there. And they're extremely helpful. They guide you along the way. They provide a chartered flight. They help with some of the expenses of making Aliyah. And in the end, when we get there on Wednesday, the amount of time we'll spend in the immigration office in the airport will be cut by something like 2/3 because of the assistance that they're giving us. Yes.
What can we do if we have friends or loved ones who are at risk, like with the Christmas trees or singing carols and that sort of thing? And a sort of related question is I have a friend who's like great-grandmother, all on the mother's side was Jewish, and then Anglican, and through all these different things, and it got down to him. So he still has the bloodline, but he himself has chosen to be Muslim. Should I talk to him about Judaism? Should I say, you know, it could be good, but...
Yeah, I think so. You know, to answer your first question, what can we do about those that are at risk? I think that the answer, first of all, lies in ourselves. And I think that people are afraid to talk about this, but we need to create a Judaism that is warm and is inviting. And the interesting thing about that is that, yes, it has to do with the synagogue service and all of this other stuff, but where is the center of Judaism? Is it in the synagogue? No, it's in the home. And the best way that you can provide a warm and loving Jewish environment to somebody is to fill your home with Jewish traditions that are warm and meaningful and to invite others to partake of it. So, for instance, for me, what that means, and it may not mean the same thing for everybody here, but for me, what that means is bringing people into my home for a Shabbat meal. And on Shabbat, in my home, we not only sing them in Hebrew, we sing the things in English as well. And we sing a lot. And we sing together, and we sing joyfully, and Shabbat has this tremendous meaning. And yes, it's a very long evening, but when people leave there, they feel like they've really experienced something not only warm and family, but spiritual. So that's one of the first things, is to create in the synagogue, but also in the home, in events and environment that will bring people to have a connection with Judaism that's warm and meaningful. If they can get something out of Hanukkah or out of Sukkot that is even more amazing than anything they could get out of having a Hanukkah bush, then we can explain to them why maybe they shouldn't be doing that. Or maybe we don't even need to explain it to them because maybe they'll want to discover more of it themselves. If this young man that you're talking about is halachically Jewish because his mother is Jewish, because her mother was Jewish, because her mother is Jewish, then yes, what I would do is I would encourage you to tell him, look, you know, I know you've chosen this other religion, and that's fine if that's what you want to do. But have you really, really looked into Judaism? I mean, really looked into it before you made this decision? And he might say yes, and then you can maybe challenge him. Well, what did you look into? Where did you go? What did you do? Maybe challenge him to see that maybe he didn't look as deeply as he could have. And then start inviting him to things. You know, invite him to a Shabbat meal. Or if that's not something that happens in your home, try to find, I don't know what you have here in Toronto, but if you have an NCSY youth group or something like that, that you can invite him to a place where the people there really enjoy being Jewish, you know? And maybe, just maybe, he might see something that will make him look a little deeper. Yes. Okay. Okay, so the first question was the name of the man from Jews for Judaism who helped me. His name is Mark Powers. He's no longer with the organization, but he was with the organization for many, many, many years in Baltimore. also in Pennsylvania. And my Hebrew name, Penina, I was given when I was born, and I used it for a little bit when I was a child. However, my legal name is Felicia, and I used that for several years, although I hated it when I was in high school. I always was trying to find a different name to use. And I adopted my Hebrew name again into general use when we started the Messianic congregation. So I've been going by my Hebrew name for 13, 14 years now. So, yes. Okay, so the question was, what was the turning point that convinced me that Jesus was not my Messiah, my Savior? The one issue that was brought up in my home, that my husband, when the guy says to us, you know, okay, so let's talk about why you think Jesus is the Messiah, and my husband says, oh, because he was born from a virgin. Okay, so in all of my 17 years of being in Christian leadership, I had never heard this challenged at all, which is kind of amazing to me now, but it's the way it was. And so when I saw that in context, well, first of all, when I saw that the word doesn't even mean virgin, they use, but when I saw in context that the sign that the prophet is giving to the king in this passage actually has absolutely nothing to do with the child or the woman. It's about these two kings who are going to disappear before this child that's mentioned is old enough to know right from wrong. So we'll say about 3 years old, okay? He's just a timepiece. He's just a clock. He's not even part of the sign. The sign is that these two kings are going to be toast. And when I realized that all this time, I had been understanding this whole concept completely wrong, that it was based on a lie. See, for me, the issue was, this was not a true proof. And when one by one by one by one, every single one was being shown to me not to be true. When you look at, I was told that the prophecy of the 70 weeks in the book of Daniel pointed to the exact day that Jesus came and died. And then when I went back and I looked, that there were four different times, that it says from the time that the call goes out to rebuild Jerusalem, and that there were four of them. You could have chose any of those four to begin the count. And the one that Christianity chooses isn't even a call to rebuild Jerusalem, it's a call to rebuild the breach in the wall. Okay? And then, even with that, they had to use a 360-day calendar year in order to come up with the numbers, which doesn't exist. I realized this was all a fairy tale. It was all made up to support a preconceived notion that somebody else had. And for me, and this is not the case with everybody, but for me, seeking God and serving God in truth, truth was the ultimate important thing in my life. And when I realized that what I had been believing all these years were based on lies, I couldn't embrace it anymore. Yes. It's fine, either one. Right. Okay. For sure. The first question had to do with the messianic idea that, you know, when it says in Deuteronomy that, you know, if someone comes along who's a dreamer of dreams and he gives all these prophecies, whatever, you're not supposed to believe him. The problem is, when you believe something, first of all, you can make anything you want fit that belief. Second of all, as someone said the other night, it's not because something is the truth that I believe it. It's that because I believe it, it's the truth. It's like the story that they say, I don't remember which Magid tells the story, but he tells the story of a man who's walking through the woods and he sees a bullseye on a tree with a, an arrow, and this is like a famous Jews for Judaism story, so I apologize if you've heard it a billion times, but he sees an arrow in the middle of the bullseye on the tree, right? And he says, wow, the person who shot this is a really great marksman. And he's going through, and he sees another one, and he sees another one, and he sees another one. And the long and the short of it is, he finds the man who was doing this, and he says to him, did you shoot those arrows? And he says, yes, I did. And he says, how did you do it? You're an amazing marksman. You need to be part of the king's army. He says, no, wait a minute. First, I shot the arrow, and then I drew the bullseye around it. Okay? But that's exactly what's happening with Christianity. In fact, there's a man named Walter Riggins who wrote a book. He's a Hebrew Christian of some sort, who wrote a book called Yeshua ben David. And on page 155 in this book, and you'll please forgive me, I'm going to summarize because I don't have it memorized. He says that, in essence, you cannot, by reading the Jewish Bible, the Tanakh, from cover to cover, come to the conclusion that Jesus is the Messiah, unless you already believe that he is. And then you can go back and see how it fits in. Okay? So it does not matter what proof you show them. If they are bound and determined to believe it, something else has to change. There has to be some other catalyst to make them be willing to look at it through different eyes. Do they deal with it? I'm sure they do. I mean, basically, when I was a Hebrew Christian, when I came across something that didn't make sense, like when you're talking about in Jeremiah chapter 30, where it says that God's going to create a new covenant, and in Christianity we said that the new covenant had already come. But it says that when this new covenant comes, that no man is going to have to tell his brother to believe in, to know God, right? And I used to be like, well, I mean, there's still an awful lot of people who don't even know that there's a God. I mean, how could this be? Well, maybe it's because the majority of people know that there's a God. Or, I could always reason away why this still held to be true, even if it didn't completely make sense. In this case, I could easily tell you that everything that Jesus said was true. Now, you will tell me, no, that's not true, and I can prove it to you. But in Christianity, they'll tell you, yes, it is. Everything he said, every prophecy he ever gave was fulfilled. It came true. He's a prophet. He's God. You know? That's the way they deal with it. They just fudge it, just like the 360-day year in Daniel. And what was the second question? The evangelical support of Israel is not just a hot topic. It really is a double-edged sword, because the support is genuine. They honestly and earnestly believe that Israel has to belong to the Jews. Okay? So, on the one hand, it is what it looks like it is. On the other hand, evangelical Christians firmly believe that if you don't believe in Jesus, you're going to hell. And the gospel is supposed to go to the Jew first. And so they will evangelize no matter what. And there's organizations like Bridges for Peace who do an amazing amount of work in Israel, not just supporting the country, but providing things for people, because there's an awful lot of poverty in Israel, and they provide clothing and they provide food, and they stuff a little Bible in the basket every once in a while, and they have an adoption program where their Christian families will pray for their Jewish family that they've adopted, and they'll invite them over, and they'll do all of these things. You know, so is it dangerous? Absolutely. What are we supposed to do about it? I don't have a clue. I think that we need to educate people that this is not something we need to believe in. There are some organizations, I will tell you, there are some evangelical Christian organizations that are happy enough to just let you know that it's Christians that are supporting you and do not do any proselytizing. We even got help from one in making Aliyah, okay? But, because their only purpose is to get Jews into the land. But they want you to know that they're evangelical Christians, that Christians are being good to Jews. I don't know that anybody has the answer to that. I'm sorry, time for one more question? Okay. I'll go ahead and take the one in the back then. And then what we're going to do is, I think there's some refreshments, and I will be hanging around. I will also be here tomorrow. I'm not speaking during the seminar, but I will be here for the seminar. So if anybody wants to talk to me, you are welcome to talk to me. Go ahead.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead and come up to the microphone so that they can hear you. Sorry.
That I know who come
back to Judaism were in the leadership. Now, I know when a Jew goes to a Messianic congregation or any church, they roll up the red carpet. And I was curious if you knew, either in your own case or other cases, how the Messianic or the Christian congregation deals with the fact that their leadership is now to certain, well, in many cases, I happen to know six former Christian pastors, ministers, Messianic rabbis who are now from. I've always wondered what the reaction is. I don't know if you know, but I was wondering.
It's denial. Well, I will tell you that when we moved to the Orthodox community, we're getting ready to move to the Orthodox community with the blessing of our congregation in order to witness to these people. We were taken aside by one particular Messianic pastor who warned us to be very careful that we would, that the community would try to convert us. When we came back to Judaism, my sister and her husband were firmly warned to spend as little time with us as possible for fear that they were going to come back. Now, the interesting thing is I get emails all the time, especially I had a radio interview last week, a few weeks ago, and afterwards I was just totally inundated with emails. And several of the emails were saying things along the lines of, it's got to be the truth because all these Jews are accepting it. And I wanted to scream and say, yeah, but you don't realize how many of them are coming back. And so one of the things that I'm asking is, as part of the organization I'm starting, I have a website, it's shomreyemet.com, and what I want is anybody who has a story, who was involved in Christianity, to write, you know, they don't need to write their book for me. They'll write their book for themselves, but just to write a paragraph or two, because I want like a hall of fame, wall of fame kind of thing to show how many hundreds, maybe even thousands of us there are out there who are Jews who went to Christianity and have come back, or who were involved in Christianity and have converted to Judaism, because there are very many of us.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I'm not going to take any more questions. Anyway, I will take more questions this evening, and I will be around tomorrow, so thank you.
Thank you.